This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Brandt Industries McLean County plant manager Hans Rasmussen says it's not your typical dirty manufacturing facility.
I was planning to stay with Kongskilled, but when I heard the ideas and initiatives that Brandt wanted to do, it seemed like a good opportunity.
GLT's Eric Stock takes a tour of the Brandt shop with Rasmussen. Plus, John Norton brings you the music of CJ Chenier. Ryan Denham reports on the insurance industry labor shortage. And Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner stops by. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington aldermen have finally voted to install new wayfinding signs in downtown, a project that has been talked about for more than 4 years. It's that kind of slow-motion decision-making that Mayor Terry Renner called out again last night during his State of the City address. Renner is in studio with GLT's Ryan Denham.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after the regular council meetings. Mayor Renner, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thank you very much, Ryan. I'm always great to be here.
Well, Mayor Renner, you delivered the State of the City address at last night's meeting. Much of it focused on big capital projects. Why now is finally time to pull the trigger on some of this stuff. I think your exact words were, timidity never produces effective results. So what should be first? O'Neill Pool, a new library, downtown transfer center? Where would you want to start?
Well, I think we need to pursue all of those. And I don't mean that they would all be built at the same time, but that we would begin to commit funds at the same time. And that is, if we say, all right, the library, we're going to begin, let's say, phase two of planning it, and then phase three of additional plans, and maybe we begin construction in 3 years. That's different from O'Neill Pool, which needs construction immediately. And we've also talked about the Hamilton Road extension, which has lots of benefits that we certainly can talk about. But that is something that is going to take a while because we still have to continue to deal with Norfolk Southern because we want an at-grade crossing. And there are certainly some deals that we can work out with them, perhaps even closing off some of the downtown Bloomington, or excuse me, west side of Bloomington, one downtown Bloomington crossing. So maybe we can cut a deal with them in moving forward, but that's going to take a longer period of time. I think we need to make a commitment, a budgetary commitment, a policy commitment on all of these projects as soon as possible, because we can do them. And we're not going to do them literally all at once, but we can make the commitment up front. As I said, I think this is the time for bold action.
Well, how do you pay for bold action? What form could this take between taking on a little bit more debt, raising fees or taxes? How do you put the money together to pay for
usually
some of these
it's
things?
A combination of those, and or it could be, you know, if we've got an anchor project in downtown, let's say it's a private development, public-private partnership, the investment of the private developer pays for itself. So there are a variety of different ways that you pay for these things. Certainly, we've got some bonds that are about to retire. And that what that means is that we will not have to make those, in effect, mortgage payments anymore. We certainly can afford, let's say, if you do a $300,000 a year bond over 20 to 30 years, that is serious money, and that is a serious impact. O'Neill Pool would be a smaller, much smaller slice, you know, than that. That would be maybe a 10-year in effect, mortgage in order to make that happen. And I think it's really critical for our West Side and our overall community, because if we don't have activities for our at-risk youth or for many youth throughout the community, East and West Side, but especially the West Side, then we are going to have other kinds of problems down the line.
So last night during the State of the City, are you speaking to current aldermen on this in terms of this come on, let's go message, or are you speaking to the next council? We got an election coming up April 2nd.
All of the above, and to all citizens, because it's really critical for citizens to be involved. If they believe that we need to push the vision we have in our comprehensive plan, and that we need to act, and that we need to be a vibrant, dynamic community, then contact your alderman, because the people, the very small group of people who don't want anything to happen, who seem sometimes to be against everything since the invention of the wheel, are definitely going to be grousing and talking to their alderman. So we need the people who have a positive vision, share that vision, the 8,000 people who were involved in our comprehensive plan, for example, to talk to their alderman and say, yes, we are ready. We do need to have an improved library. We do need to have a revitalized older neighborhood, a revitalized downtown. We do need to make investments in O'Neill Pool and in our transportation system. We need to work with Connect Transit for a downtown transfer center. We need to do these things. And that, I think, so it's really all of the above to the citizens of Bloomington, as well as the council, as well as the new council, because we know that at least one third of the council is going to be new in about 3 months.
And you talked about the possibility of a private developer getting involved with some of this, and maybe they do a downtown project, let's say, and it's private money in that instance. But for some of these public projects, O'Neill Pool being one of them, How much borrowing do you think you as mayor and your council are willing to stomach to get some of this stuff done? How much money would you have to borrow?
Well, it depends on how big and the scope of the project would be. If all we're going to do is fix O'Neill Pool, that's a comparatively small amount of money, a few million dollars, and that's a fairly small bond. We might even be, I don't think we should tap into our reserves. We've built our reserves. Every year, in fact, we give money back to the budget from the budget to the reserves to build up our savings. So I don't think we want to tap into that. But that would be comparatively small. If we turn it into an aquatic center that we have to view as an investment in economic development, that might be more along the lines of a $10, $12 million project. That doesn't mean that we pay for that out of this week's paycheck. That is something that we could float over perhaps 20 years. 15, 20 years. So that's maybe more along the lines of $600,000, depending on the interest rate, as a payment. So that we may need to prioritize and we go forward with. But also fixing our streets and infrastructure, right? I mean, I don't want to say no day goes by, but it seems like no day goes by where somebody doesn't say, can you do something to help fix these streets? I know we've neglected them for a long time, but come on. And we are making progress, but the progress is slow because streets don't pave themselves. They cost money. And so what I think we would do, and I strongly support, frankly, is a 4-penny a gallon gas tax locally. The thing about a 4-penny a gallon gas tax is no future council can take that money and put it into anything except streets and infrastructure related to streets. The other thing is, 30 cents out of the dollar are paid by people who do not live in Bloomington but use our streets. There are a variety of means. I'm sorry. There are a variety of ways that we would move forward. Some would maybe a 30-year bond like a library, maybe even a 40-year bond with a library, maybe a 30, 40-year bond with sewers, maybe a 10, 15-year bond with the with O'Neill Pool, and then private sector or maybe a 4-penny a gallon gas tax.
Well, last night you also mentioned trying to acquire strategic properties in downtown. In the past, when we've talked about this, you and I, you've referenced this when talking about the front and center building there on Front Street across from...
That would certainly be a strategic property, yeah. If not one of the most strategic in downtown Bloomington.
So are you guys going to finally move on that and try to make a move?
That would probably require us to use eminent domain, which I think the council is actually at this point ready for. I can't speak for all of them, but I have not gotten anyone on the council to say they are absolutely opposed to that. But that is a very long, cumbersome process. But it's something we have to, we've got to move on that. We cannot allow that building to just rot. Two fire chiefs now have described it as the largest fire hazard in our downtown. So, and it could be an asset, and it's diagonally from the Coliseum. And so what that means is it's not helping us getting gigs in the Coliseum. It is costing taxpayers And I think there comes a time where you have to say enough's enough. Now, when I, in terms of the, we have really only bought a few properties downtown. We bought the, if you call the
parking
old
meatpacking
plant.
Right?
Well, we bought parking. We bought some parking lots. But if you call the old meatpacking place right south of the library downtown, we've purchased that. And then north of downtown, we purchased the Electrolux property, which we're also moving on, in fact, even as we speak. So if you own strategic properties, you can control them. Certainly, that's one of the lessons that downtown or uptown Normal learned from the very beginning.
So what's next on the potential for front and center? If your perception is the council's willing to do eminent domain, what's next?
And that's part of what we have to talk to staff about, because we're juggling many things. We would certainly act on it. Do we wait until after the new council elections, which are May 1st, and at this point focus more on the Electrolux site, and move along some other projects? And possibly, a new agreement with the Coliseum. Do we do those over the next few months? And then maybe as of May, hit the pedal to the metal on that. Those are decisions that the city manager and I and some of the council members are going to need to make in the next few weeks.
Well, last night during the State of the City, you also got into the value of partnerships and trying to partner up with other organizations, other government entities. Connect Transit obviously is interested in pursuing a downtown transfer center.
There's certainly nothing more important than that.
So what's the city's role in that? How much city money, city finding a location, that kind of stuff? How involved is the city on that?
Well, I think in terms of city, certainly city finding a helping with a location and anything else that we can, and in terms of getting other grants. Connect Transit has some money. They have the ability to get additional money. If they partner with us, it might be possible for us to get even more money from the state or even the federal government. Some of it depends on the nature of the project. Is it a project like what you see in Uptown, where you're really joining at the hip with Connect Transit, or is it a strategic location, let's say across from the Coliseum or the old parking garage or the Market Street parking garage? Where is that? So I think it depends on the nature of the project. Actually, we're meeting this afternoon to talk about this very thing.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Renner, last night, aldermen approved spending $580,000 to install 34 new wayfinding signs in and around the downtown area. What did you think of that?
I think this is way overdue. And I was very impressed with the signs and certainly welcoming people to downtown Bloomington kind of almost as an arch coming in and letting people know that this has been since 1830. This adds to historic character of our downtown and branding. But it also will help us to get our share and more of the Route 66 Visitor Center traffic. We do have the Route 66 Visitor Center that took a long time to get money for also. But once that's opened and proper signage from the interstates and with Normal acting as a great partner in this, we are now starting to get our share of this. People used to drive from Pontiac and drive around Bloomington Normal and go to Atlanta, Illinois, right, on Route 66, not going through our respective cities. We are changing that. This is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and that's important for jobs. It's important for economic growth. And so that also is a very high priority. Obviously, we've got lots of high priorities, and we're trying to put the pedal to the metal on a lot of things.
Well, people have phones, cell phones in their pocket all the time. They've got GPS in their cars. Why are signs like this, in your view, necessary?
Signs are necessary in any downtown revitalization for branding, for understanding that these are the boundaries of the downtown. And for people who may not have access, I mean, not the major signs, but some of the minor signs, to apps. But we have those as well. We have new technology as well as the old style of branding. Both still work, and both are still essential to downtown revitalization, really in any metro city's inner core.
Well, Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for your time again today on Sound Ideas.
Thank you, Ryan.
I'm Ryan Denham.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular council meeting. Next week, we'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Koos. That'll be Wednesday because of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday.
Support for GLT comes from SEFQ, offering competitive rates for home equity lines of credit. Borrowers get personalized service without the hidden fees or early payoff penalties. Plus, SEFQ even covers closing costs for qualified members. Information at SEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, an insurance industry crisis that doesn't have to do with weather, but rather labor. Ryan Dunham has that story in just a moment. It has been barely a year since Brandt Industries purchased the former Kongsguild plant north of Normal. The agriculture equipment maker started production in July and is revamping the 200,000-square-foot building so it can house as many as 300 employees and multiple shifts. GLT's Eric Stock gives us a tour.
It's definitely not your father's manufacturing plant. The building is nearly spotless, even as welders, painters, and others toil. A growing number of jobs are electronic, while a few tasks are completely automated. Brandt's sales manager for the northeastern U.S., Hans Rasmussen, was born in Denmark and grew up in Canada, where Brandt was born. But that's purely coincidental. He's been in McLean County since 2002, as he worked at Brandt's predecessor, Kongsguild. He explains how this all came to be.
Brandt was researching a location in the U.S. They've been selling into the U.S. for several years, but was looking for a location, physical location, to manufacture and distribute product as their market share was growing. This plant became available when Kongsguild sold off their agricultural side of the business, and Brandt was one of the companies that came to have a look at the facility and ultimately purchased it.
Explain your role in it, because you were Kongsguild at the time.
I was in charge of Kongsguild for North America, and when we sold off our agricultural division, no longer needed a facility of this size or manufacturing capability, and so it was deemed to find a buyer and hopefully somebody that could take the facility and expand on it and also provide employment opportunities for some of the staff. And Brandt was one of the people we reached out to, and they came. And after a few visits, a deal was struck.
Were you planning on sticking around?
I was planning to stay with Kongsguild, but when I heard the ideas and initiatives that Brandt was describing that they wanted to do, it seemed like a good opportunity, and I was glad to accept.
So how has it been going so far?
Better than expected. It's been a great company. They've stepped up and did what they said, not only in hiring people, but also in developing products, expansion here at the facility. Everything seems to be going the right direction.
If you would outline what all is being produced here now.
We started out making screw conveyors, augers, for farmers, and then we've added in belt conveyors, and we're adding additional products, drive-over decks, other types of belt conveyors, and ultimately grain carts is our plans for 2018-19. We also have a line of construction attachments for excavators and that type of thing that we will be distributing from here, but we will look at maybe manufacturing some of those late 19, early 2020.
We'd heard of snow blades as well?
We manufacture those in Canada at our facility there, but we have started a program where our John Deere dealer, construction dealers, will buy graders from John Deere, and prior to receiving them, they pass through here, get fitted with the snow wings, and then go to the dealer and the end user.
And how many employees are here so far, full-time?
Approximately 85 at the current time period, and we have just put notices out for another 14.
and growth potential beyond there. We had heard at one point possibly 200 to 300 employees.
That's our goal and our target, all depending on how fast we can develop the market, how fast we can get there.
Where is the ceiling as far as market potential in this industry?
Yeah, that one, we're not really sure what the ceiling is. We have competitors, obviously. The agricultural side is been in a downturn for the last several years. It seems to be slowly leveling out and possibly starting to rejuvenate, depending on all the tariffs and the China situation with soybeans. So we're not sure how long or how big it can get. Right now, we still haven't fully set up our distribution network, so we have a lot of geography where we just don't have dealers yet, which gives us opportunity for growth for the next several years.
So it sounds like you're still very much in infancy in that realm.
Yes, we are. We're definitely adding new dealers monthly.
So you referenced the tariffs. How much of an impact has that had, if any, yet, or could that potentially have on your business longer term, if this ends up being a longer-term situation?
It's not unique for us. Our competitors are having the same thing. So where it really hits is the end users. With increased prices, it slows down sales.
Any surprises, pleasant or otherwise, so far that you didn't expect in this new venture? Sounds like it's all gone according to plan.
There's always bumps, and it's like a highway. There's bumps in it, and there's smooth sections. And when you're starting out from scratch with a new company in a different country, there's always some bumps. But we've managed to get over them pretty quickly and move on.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Hans Rasmussen, who is a sales manager for the northeastern part of the United States for Brandt Industries, about 6 months after the company has opened up shop and started production here in McLean County. How many of the employees that you've added have come from this area, perhaps came from Kongskild or other places in McLean County, and how many have come in from elsewhere?
If you're looking at straight McLean County, there's been several, but also the outlying counties around the area, El Paso area, Lexington. There's probably from a 30-mile radius of here.
Was that one of the areas that was attractive to Brandt because of the available workforce and the reputation of the workforce here in McLean County?
That was one of the criteria, was availability of employees and skilled employees, but also the possibility, if there wasn't skilled employees, to get the training, i.e. through Heartland, ISU, etc.
Mm-hmm. Other parts of the arrangement that Brandt had set up with the local taxing bodies, you were going to be donating equipment, student mentoring time, other community service equal to 50% of the annual tax break. Do you have some examples of what you have done or plan to do in those areas?
We've been working heavily with Unit 5 and have had meetings with them. We have offered up some welding machines to the schools. We are also working with them on a mentoring program and some training programs that we've talked back and forth. It's still in the setup mode. In fact, we're having meetings again where they're coming out here with some students for touring and mentoring here in January.
Looking for a sustainable workforce.
Yes.
Brandt initially pledged to spend $20 million in improvements to the facilities. How close are you to that? And if you can give me some examples of some of the upgrades that you've done.
I don't have the dollar numbers right at my fingertips. We're on target to what we had said. We have added some additional cranes. We are doing some building construction right now where we have had to put some new utilities in, adding locker room, restrooms for the expanded workforce that may hit 300 people. Mm-hmm. We are also in the midst of looking at some other expansion, additions to the building, additions to equipment in the near future.
How does Brandt see its role in Bloomington Normal and McLean County as one of the larger employers in this area and getting off the ground here?
That's a hard one to answer. We do not see ourselves as one of the larger ones at this point.
Potentially, of course.
We're working towards that, and It's a family-owned company with family values. And so it's we reach out in the community when it affects what we call our family.
McLean County is the largest ag-producing county in the state. How much did that play a role in this being a strategic location for the company?
That wasn't one of the top five factors. It was a nice factor in the end. But the company had been looking at other sites prior to this facility coming on the market. They were very close to making a decision on a couple others. But when this came along, because of the size of the building and the newer equipment inside the factory, it made the decision easier to select here.
Brandon said a year ago the company was to consider making this the U.S. headquarters for the company. Is that still in the works, and what would that actually mean?
Yeah, it's still in the works for that. And ultimately, as things grow, there will be additional locations, but this will be the primary U.S. location.
Where might you be setting up elsewhere, or how many sites could potentially be in the works?
That is unknown at this point.
It sort of depends on where the market goes in the next few years then, right?
It depends on where the market goes with what products and what geography, what geographic areas are developing faster.
Rasmussen says while manufacturing appears to be on the rebound in the U.S., training and education haven't caught up. He says it's been a challenge to find qualified workers. In the meantime, he acknowledges a growing number of tasks, including some of the heavier welding jobs, can be done more efficiently through automation.
For example, when we were doing cultivator frames with Kongskill, if it took 4 man-hours to weld something, the robot could do it in 45 minutes. In order to be able to compete and get the costs down, you need to be efficient in your production, and robotics are one of the ways we have to do that.
At Branch, skilled laborers are all non-union. They can make up to $17.50 an hour. I'm Eric Stock.
Brandt manager Hans Rasmussen says all of Brandt's skilled labor jobs require prior training and certification. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.
Next time on Ask Me Another, actor Terry Crews joins us. We talk about his prolific career and his robust extracurricular talents. And then Jonathan Colton leads a music parody game that could literally save your life. Every song contains the number of beats per minute to correctly perform CPR. So join me, Ophira Eisenberg, on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia. Saturdays at 10 a.m. on GLT. Find a program schedule at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB's Community Service Grant helps GLT bring you Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you rely for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the red-hot Louisiana sound of C.J. Chenier. For American insurance companies, the next crisis on the horizon may not be a hurricane, hailstorm, or tornado. It could be finding enough of the right kind of worker. A new hiring trends report from a leading insurance industry consultant says there's a talent crisis, meaning more competition for not enough workers. That could have big implications for an insurance town like, oh, say, Bloomington Normal. Greg Jacobson is co-CEO of the Chicago-based Jacobson Group. The ISU grad says the insurance industry's unemployment rate is lower than the economy overall, just 1%.
What we're dealing with is an industry where there are far more opportunities than there are people available for those opportunities. And that means that candidates, individuals, or employees, individuals have who have certain skill sets, really have an opportunity to pick and choose who they want to be employed by, which also has an impact on you know their ability to pick and choose where they want to live. And there's a lot of implications on that.
So let's take a step back. How did that happen? How did we get to the point where our unemployment rate in this industry was so low?
Well, historically, the insurance industry has a lower unemployment rate than the general economy anyway. I mean, even if you go back to 2009, I think that the three-month rolling average of unemployment in the industry got no higher than probably 6.5-7% when the general economy was about 10.5%. But also, the industry is suffering from a couple of things. One, it's an older industry, and there are more people retiring than in other industries. The industry has not kept up by bringing new people into the industry at the same rate as those who are retiring. And it's a very technical industry where people, where companies generally like to have people who have experience directly in the industry.
When I see that your hiring trends report actually uses the word crisis to describe this, it calls it a talent crisis. So is it really that bad?
It's pretty significant. You know, I think there are businesses around the United States, insurance companies, that are not able to meet the needs of their shareholders or meet their goals, their growth goals, or their profitability goals because they don't have the talent in place to execute on their plans.
Well, before we get into retention issues, which there's a whole bunch we can talk about there, what about just getting people in the door? So what are some of the things that insurance companies are having to do to compete, to get new people? Like, how is this changing the approach to HR and the way that you market positions out there?
Well, you know, the biggest challenge is it's not that the insurance industry has a poor reputation. In fact, it really has no reputation at all among students at universities. Now, obviously, in some areas, that's not necessarily the case. I think in Bloomington Normal, Illinois State University has done a tremendous job, along with State Farm and Country Financial, to put the industry on the map. Companies are having to first educate prospective employees about what the industry does, how important it is to commerce, how mission-oriented most companies are, and how many different types of opportunities there are within the industry for people with a variety of skills.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how the insurance industry can solve its talent issues by looking outside the industry for talent and what that may mean for the way that job descriptions are written.
That's a great question. The industry is changing dramatically. In fact, it has historically been an industry that did not go through a lot of change, and probably the hottest venture capital market is in the insurtech world, technology for insurance, disruptive technology for insurance, over the last couple of years. So we are seeing huge changes in the industry, which is creating the need for different types of skills than ever before in the industry. So there are opportunities for the insurance industry to look outside of its traditional boundaries, which are other insurance companies, and bring in people that have backgrounds and experiences from other industries. Now, what you have to do, to your question about rewriting job descriptions, is you have to really focus on the skills and characteristics that are required for success within the insurance industry, not necessarily the experience, which is something that we advocate for our clients on a national basis.
State Farm in recent years has opened hubs in Dallas, Phoenix, and Atlanta, on top of the headquarters here in Bloomington. One reason for that, we've been told, is to help attract talent that's already in those cities. So how does that square with your research in this report here?
The insurance industry as a whole has this challenge beyond a company like State Farm, because the industry, especially the property and casualty industry, has historically been built around farm communities, farm towns, rural areas, because that's the history of insurance, is farmers getting together and insuring themselves. So many of the largest insurers in the United States are actually in smaller communities. So I think that when this crisis started hitting about 5 years ago, in terms of the amount of talent available to meet the needs of growing insurers, they started looking outside of their traditional corporate headquarters and said, where can we find talent that meets our needs that may not necessarily be in the home office. And my guess is that's probably what drove, you know, some of the decisions by State Farm as well as other insurers.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Greg Jacobson from the Jacobson Group, which just put out its 2019 hiring trends report for the insurance industry. Greg, we've got State Farm and Country Financial here in town, one giant and one pretty big insurer. Is this talent crisis impacting insurers the same, like regardless of size, or does it vary?
The impact is being felt at a greater level with smaller companies. And I'm talking about, on a national basis, even companies considerably smaller than Country. So I think that smaller companies are having a very significant challenge attracting the talent that's required in order for them to meet their needs. And part of that is because they don't have as many resources to develop talent like companies like State Farm do, as well as Country. So we're seeing as this, you know, companies are smaller, serving a niche of the industry, or a niche of an industry, we're seeing these companies having a more difficult time bringing in the talent that's necessary for them to be successful.
Well, let's talk about retention. Your report also calls attention to the impact that a big organizational change has on employee retention. And that resonates here, I think, because State Farm spent much of 2018 doing some big company-wide reorganizations, job cuts and relocations. What impact do these kind of big modernization projects have on a company's workforce?
Well, I think the first implication is the cultural implication. And historically, many larger insurance companies have been places where people have gone jobs for have had jobs for life, and they kind of thought of their career at a specific company as the place that they would spend their entire career. And I think that State Farm was very much that way. When you go through changes like this, there can be a positive impact and there can be a negative impact of changing the culture where it's no longer seen as a job for life. The impact can be that people start to realize that, you know, they have to look out for themselves instead of having the company look out for them, and they start to consider other opportunities. We're seeing the insurance industry actually has been a laggard in seeing a large turnover or increasing turnover rate than versus other industries. You've seen more stability in the insurance industry among employees than in virtually any other industry. I think you're starting to see the turnover rate in the industry rise. And some of that is due to companies that are no longer seen as these employers of choice for life, and that's the impact that, you know, changes like this will have.
Was there anything that insurers can do to mitigate that risk of losing an employee who becomes, you know, dissatisfied with how much change is going on or how they're working on the project that may, you know, lead to their own elimination? Is there anything they can do to mitigate that?
Yeah, I think so. I think companies need to be transparent about what they're doing. And they need to be engaging employees on a regular basis about the reasons for change and the needs for change and the impact. They also can be very instrumental in helping affected employees find other work, and that will come across as very empathetic to some of these changes. That's what companies, people are looking for. That's what people are looking for. They're looking for companies who have empathetic leadership, transparent leadership, and are giving them opportunities to continue to grow based on the needs of the organization.
Well, the insurance industry, as you mentioned, has a very low unemployment rate, lower than the economy at large, just 1.2% as of late last fall. You know, but obviously there's a little bit of movement in certain companies. Nationwide Insurance, I think in November, announced it was cutting 1,100 jobs. State Farm shed a few hundred jobs itself last year. So are those just kind of like short-term outliers? How should we read those in the context of the overall industry hiring trends that you're sort of describing here?
I think they are outliers in the context of the overall industry, and I think that in many cases those people at the companies that you mentioned are finding other opportunities pretty quickly, because there are companies that have, you know, openings. In fact, you know, there are companies that will set up strategies around, you know, bringing on the talent of some of these affected individuals at these companies.
That's Greg Jacobson from the Chicago-based Jacobson Group, which just put out its 2019 hiring trends report for the insurance industry. I'm Ryan Denham.
Jacobson's 2019 hiring trends report says two-thirds of all insurers plan to increase their staff sizes in the next year. Find a link to the full report at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. C.J. Chenier is the son of the late Clifton Chenier, known as the King of Zydeco. Today, he leads the Red Hot Louisiana Band, the band once led by his father, and today considered the premier Zydeco band in the world. Ahead of his appearance at the Castle Theater Saturday, John Norton caught up with Chenier at his home in Houston to talk about the music that has taken him around the world.
All right, John.
Chenier's Zydeco future was not a given at birth, despite being the son of Zydeco royalty. And according to Chenier, the songs he plays aren't even technically Zydeco.
Zydeco consists of, like, when you go to a Zydeco dance, you're going to hear a variety of music. You're going to hear blues, boogie, waltzes, ballads. But a natural Zydeco song is stripped down with drums, accordion, and washboard. But when you go to a Zydeco dance, you're going to hear all those other elements I told you about.
And so, in a sense, that's kind of what you're doing now, then. You're mixing all of that.
Well, that's what it always was. I mean, that's the way I learned it from my daddy. See, I knew nothing before I started playing with him.
Let's go there, because everyone knows you as a Zydeco artist who plays a mean accordion and took over his father's band. And we should mention, Clifton Chenier was your father. He was dubbed the King of Zydeco. But it was almost like it was assumed that from a young age that you play the accordion, you grew up on Zydeco, and you grew up with your father, none of which was true. You grew up playing the saxophone.
Exactly.
And you were away from your father for a while, and you weren't even that aware of what Zydeco was when you were a kid.
Exactly. I mean, it wasn't nowhere near as popular as it is now. You never heard it on the radio. Only time you would hear Zydeco is when a few artists like my daddy and Ducey that were traveling around, that's the only time you heard it. You know, so it's like if they didn't pound the pavement, nobody would know what Zydeco was. I learned to mix it all up. So that's why I describe myself now as Zydeco Blues, because I want to be distinguished to know that the style that I play is mixed with blues. As my daddy was, he played Zydeco, but he ought to tell you in a New York second, he was a blues man. That's the way he felt in his heart. But the style he created, the washboard, the drums, and the accordion sound only is what a Zydeco song is.
Hey, guitar man.
Last time you were in town, we talked, and we talked about the album Desperate Kingdom of Love, and you recorded your dad's songs, two of them anyway, Black Snake Blues and the Boogaloosa Boogie, on that album. But what we didn't talk about was the album title and the song that took that title, Desperate Kingdom of Love. It's a P.J. Harvey song.
Right.
Why were you attracted? That just Zydeco and P.J. Harvey just don't seem to go together, but you chose it for this album. How come?
Well, it was a somber song, and my agent, I really didn't know what the song was, and my booking agent at the time played it for me, and the record company kind of wanted it, and, you know, it was not supposed to be an upbeat, happy CD. It was supposed to be a mellow, kind of somber thing because of Katrina, and I did it right after that. And they came up with that song, man. I'm listening to it. I'm like, wow, that's different. And it kind of grew on me after a while, and after we started playing around with it a little bit, you know, it just, you know, if you feel it, man, you can do it. And I felt it after a while, and, you know, just to decide to go with it.
Oh, love, you were a sickly child, and how the wind knocked you down.
You're from Port Arthur, Texas. You mentioned Katrina. Port Arthur was also hit hard by Katrina. New Orleans took a long time to recover from that huge hurricane. How about Port Arthur? How was that 13-some years later?
13-some years later, now it's dealing with Harvey and some other stuff. Port Arthur almost got washed away, man. It was like a big old lake with some rooftops sticking out the top of it. You know, that's what it looked like in Port Arthur, and they're still trying to recover from that.
So you're talking about Harvey now? Harvey hit Port Arthur as well?
Yeah, well, it keep getting, that place keep getting hit. You know, it got hit by Katrina, and you still see blue tarps on some of the houses that the roof got blown off today. And then and on top of that, it's been hit by a couple of more storms since that. So it's like it's almost trying to wash the little city away, man. But it's hanging in there, you know.
Wow. C.J. Chenier is our guest. He and the Red Hot Louisiana Band at the Castle Theater on the 19th. I'm John Norton. You've played with an interesting array of musicians outside your band as well. Paul Simon on the Rhythm of the Saints album. That was his follow-up to the Graceland album.
It was one song, and I can't quite remember the name of it. It was a fast song. I remember that, and I remember Paul Simon being a perfectionist.
Was that a good thing, or was it challenging?
It was different for me because, you know, in Zydeco, the way I learned to record from my dad is you got to go in there with the energy. To try to go in there and play like you're performing for an audience so you can get that real energy comes through on your CD. And with Paul Simon, I think I did about 20 takes of the same song. And when it was all said and done, he picked a little part here, a part there, a part there, a part here, a part there, and he patched it all together to get what he wanted out of what I played.
Silver bells tingling from your black lizard boots, my baby, silver foil to trim your wedding gown.
Since you were here, Buckwheat Zydeco played the GLT Summer Concert. He was our headliner a few years ago, and he has since passed. He played organ in your father's band, and obviously the two of you became close, right, after a while?
Oh, yeah. And as a matter of fact, I was 18 years old when I first met Buckwheat, standing on side of the stage watching my dad play, and all I could look at him and say, boy, that cat on organ is a bad son of a gun.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did a lot of touring together.
His real name was Stanley Durrell. What do you miss most about Buckwheat Zydeco?
Just his presence, man. It's sort of like when my dad passed, you know. It's like this big presence in his music is gone now. And it happened with my dad, and it felt the same way when Buckwheat passed. It's like a big, big presence in Zydeco is gone now, you know.
Does that put extra pressure on you?
I've never felt pressure. I'm just the type of person, I just like to go on stage and do what I do and have fun. You know, even with my dad, man, it never felt like pressure, even though I know people, new people thought I was going to be him. But
well, what I'm getting at, CJ, is that you are one of the bigger names now in Zydeco that would carry on this tradition.
I look at it as carrying on is just to continue to perform, and that's what I'm going to do, man. So yeah, I'm going to be here as long as I possibly can, performing. So that is carrying, you know, carrying on. If they call me to play, I'll be there, you know, wherever it is. I'm always ready to continue the Zydeco tradition.
That's C.J. Chenier talking with GLT's John Norton. Chenier led the Red Hot Louisiana Band this Saturday at the Castle Theater in Bloomington. You can hear Chenier's music on GLT Blues Radio at WGLT.org. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from John Norton, Brian Denham, and Eric Stock. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.